But Darwin's interests range far beyond theology. Holed up in a room above a tobacconist's shop on Sydney Street, he had occupied himself by collecting beetles, studying botany and geology, learning geometry and physics, and arguing hotly about God, divine intervention, and the creation of animals. More than theology or philosophy, Darwin was drawn to natural history, the study of the natural world using systematic scientific principles. He apprenticed with another clergyman, John Henslow, the botanist and geologist who had created and curated the Cambridge Botanic Garden, the vast outdoor museum of natural history where Darwin first learned to collect, identify, and classify plant and animal specimens. Two books particularly ignited Darwin's imagination during his student years. The first, Natural Theology, published in 1802 by William Paley, the former vicar of Dalston, made an argument that would resonate deeply with Darwin. Suppose, Paley wrote, a man walking across a heath happens upon a watch lying on the ground. He picks up the instrument and opens it to find an exquisite system of cogs and wheels turning inside, resulting in a mechanical device that is capable of telling time. Would it not be logical to assume that such a device could only have been manufactured by a watchmaker? The same logic had to apply to the natural world, Paley reasoned. The exquisite construction of organisms and human organs, the pivot upon which the head turns, the ligament within the socket of the hip joint, could point to only one fact, that all organisms were created by a supremely proficient designer, a divine watchmaker, God. The second book, A Preliminary Discourse on the Study of Natural Philosophy, published in 1830 by the astronomer Sir John Herschel, suggested a radically different view. At first glance, the natural world seems incredibly complex, Herschel acknowledged. But science can reduce seemingly complex phenomena into causes and effects. Motion is the result of a force impinging on an object. Heat involves the transference of energy. Sound is produced by the vibration of air. Herschel had little doubt that chemical and ultimately biological phenomena would also be attributed to such cause and effect mechanisms. Herschel was particularly interested in the creation of biological organisms, and his methodical mind broke the problem down to its two basic components. The first was the problem of the creation of life from non-life, Genesis ex nihilo. Here he could not bring himself to challenge the doctrine of the divine creation. To ascend to the origin of things and speculate on creation is not the business of the natural philosopher, he wrote. Organs and organisms might behave according to the laws of physics and chemistry, but the genesis of life itself could never be understood through these laws. It was as if God had given Adam a nice little laboratory in Eden, but then forbidden him from peering over the walls of the garden. But the second problem, Herschel thought, was more tractable. Once life had been created, what process generated the observed diversity of the natural world? How, for instance, did a new species of animal arise from another species? Anthropologists studying language had demonstrated that new languages arose from old languages through the transformation of words. Sanskrit and Latin words could be traced back to mutations and variations in ancient Indo-European language, and English and Flemish had arisen from a common root. Geologists had proposed that the current shape of the earth, its rocks, chasms, and mountains, had been created by the transmutation of previous elements. Battered relics of past ages, Herschel wrote, contain indelible records capable of intelligible interpretation. It was an illuminating insight. A scientist could understand the present and the future by examining the battered relics of the past. Herschel did not have the correct mechanism for the origin of species, but he posed the correct question. He called this the mystery of mysteries. Natural history, the subject that gripped Darwin at Cambridge, was not particularly poised to solve Herschel's mystery of mysteries. To the fiercely inquisitive Greeks, the study of living beings had been intimately linked to the question of the origin of the natural world. But medieval Christians were quick to realize that this line of inquiry could only lead to unsavory theories. Nature was God's creation, and to be safely consistent with Christian doctrine, natural historians had to tell the story of nature in terms of Genesis. A descriptive view of nature, i.e. the identification, naming, and classification of plants and animals, was perfectly acceptable In describing nature's wonders, you were, in effect, celebrating the immense diversity of living beings created by an omnipotent God. But a mechanistic view of nature threatened to cast doubt on the very basis of the doctrine of creation. To ask why and when animals were created, by what mechanism or force, was to challenge the myth of divine creation and edge dangerously close to heresy. Perhaps unsurprisingly, by the late 18th century, the discipline of natural history was dominated by so-called parson naturalists, vicars, parsons, abbots, deacons, and monks who cultivated their gardens and collected plant and animal specimens to service the wonders of divine creation, but generally veered away from questioning its fundamental assumptions. The church provided a safe haven for these scientists, but it also effectively neutered their curiosity. The injunctions against the wrong kinds of investigation were so sharp that the parson naturalists did not even question the myths of creation. It was the perfect separation of church and mental state. The result was a peculiar distortion of the field. Even as taxonomy, the classification of plant and animal species, flourished, inquiries into the origin of living beings were relegated to the forbidden sidelines. Natural history devolved into the study of nature without history. It was this static view of nature that Darwin found troubling. A natural historian should be able to describe the state of the natural world in terms of causes and effects, Darwin reasoned, just as a physicist might describe the motion of a ball in the air. The essence of Darwin's disruptive genius was his ability to think about nature not as fact, but as process, as progression, as history. It was a quality that he shared with Mendel. Both clergymen, both gardeners, both obsessive observers of the natural world, Darwin and Mendel made their crucial leaps by asking variants of the same question. How does nature come into being? Mendel's question was microscopic. How does a single organism transmit information to its offspring over a single generation? Darwin's question was macroscopic. How do organisms transmute information about their features over 1,000 generations? In time, both visions would converge, giving rise to the most important synthesis in modern biology and the most powerful understanding of human heredity. In August 1831, 2 months after his graduation from Cambridge, Darwin received a letter from his mentor, John Henslow. An exploratory survey of South America had been commissioned, and the expedition required the service of a gentleman scientist who could assist in collecting specimens. Although more gentleman than scientist, having never published a major scientific paper, Darwin thought himself a natural fit. He was to travel on the Beagle not as a finished naturalist, but as a scientist in training, amply qualified for collecting, observing, and noting anything worthy to be noted in natural history. The Beagle lifted anchor on December 27, 1831, with 73 sailors on board, clearing a gale and tacking southward toward Tenerife. By early January, Darwin was heading toward Cape Verde. The ship was smaller than he had expected, and the wind more treacherous. The sea churned constantly beneath him. He was lonely, nauseated, and dehydrated, surviving on a diet of dry raisins and bread. That month he began writing notes in his journal. Slung on a hammock bed above the salt-starched survey maps, he pored over the few books that he had brought with him on the voyage. Milton's Paradise Lost, which seemed all too apposite to his condition, and Charles Lyell's Principles of Geology, published between 1830 and 1833. Lyell's work in particular left an impression on him. Lyell had argued, radically for his time, that complex geological formations, such as boulders and mountains, had been created over vast stretches of time, not by the hand of God, but by slow natural processes such as erosion, sedimentation, and deposition. Rather than a colossal biblical flood, Lyell argued, there had been millions of floods. God had shaped the earth not through singular cataclysms, but through a million paper cuts. For Darwin, Lyell's central idea of the slow heave of natural forces shaping and reshaping the earth, sculpting nature, would prove to be a potent intellectual spur. In February 1832, still squeamish and uncomfortable, Darwin crossed over to the southern hemisphere. The winds changed direction, and the currents altered their flow, and a new world floated out to meet him. Darwin, as his mentors had predicted, proved to be an excellent collector and observer of specimens. As the Beagle hopscotched its way down the eastern coast of South America, passing through Montevideo, Bahia Blanca, and Port Desire, he rifled through the bays, rainforests, and cliffs, hauling aboard a vast assortment of skeletons, plants, pelts, rocks, and shells. "Cargoes of apparent rubbish," the captain complained. The land yielded not just a cargo of living specimens, but ancient fossils as well. Laying them out on long lines along the deck, it was as if Darwin had created his own museum of comparative anatomy. In September 1832, exploring the gray cliffs and low-lying clay bays near Punta Alta, he discovered an astonishing natural cemetery, with fossilized bones of enormous extinct mammals splayed out before him. He pried out the jaw of one fossil from the rock like a mad dentist, then returned the next week to extract a huge skull from the quartz. The skull belonged to a megatherium, a mammoth version of a sloth. That month, Darwin found more bones strewn among the pebbles and rocks. In November, he paid 18 pence to a Uruguayan farmer for a piece of a colossal skull of yet another extinct mammal, the rhino-like toxodon with giant squirrel teeth that had once roamed the plains. "I have been wonderfully lucky," he wrote. "Some of the mammals were gigantic, and many of them are quite new." He collected fragments from a pig-sized guinea pig, armor plates from a tank-like armadillo, more elephantine bones from elephantine sloths, and crated and shipped them to England. The Beagle rounded the sharp jaw bend of Tierra del Fuego and climbed the western coast of South America. In 1835, the ship left Lima, on the coast of Peru, and headed toward a lonely spray of charred volcanic islands west of Ecuador, the Galapagos. The archipelago was black, dismal-looking heaps of broken lava forming a shore fit for pandemonium, the captain wrote. It was a Garden of Eden of a hellish sort. Isolated, untouched, parched, and rocky, turds of congealed lava overrun by hideous iguanas, tortoises, and birds. The ship wandered from island to island. There were about 18 in all, and Darwin ventured ashore, scrambling through the pumice, collecting birds, plants, and lizards. The crew survived on a steady diet of tortoise meat, with every island yielding a seemingly unique variety of tortoise. Over 5 weeks, Darwin collected carcasses of finches, mockingbirds, blackbirds, grosbeaks, wrens, albatrosses, iguanas, and an array of sea and land plants. The captain grimaced and shook his head. On October 20th, Darwin returned to sea, headed toward Tahiti. Back in his room aboard the Beagle, he began to systematically analyze the corpses of the birds that he had collected. The mockingbirds, in particular, surprised him. There were two or three varieties, but each subtype was markedly distinct, and each was endemic to one particular island. Offhandedly, he scribbled one of the most important scientific sentences that he would ever write. "Each variety is constant in its own island." Was the same pattern true of other animals, of the tortoises, say? Did each island have a unique tortoise type? He tried, belatedly, to establish the same pattern for the turtles, but it was too late. He and the crew had eaten the evidence for lunch. When Darwin returned to England after 5 years at sea, he was already a minor celebrity among natural historians. His vast fossil loot from South America was being unpacked, preserved, catalogued, and organized. Whole museums could be built around it. The taxidermist and bird painter John Gould had taken over the classification of the birds. Lyell himself displayed Darwin's specimens during his presidential address to the Geological Society. Richard Owen, the paleontologist who hovered over England's natural historians like a patrician falcon, descended from the Royal College of Surgeons to verify and catalog Darwin's fossil skeletons. But while Owen, Gould, and Lyell named and classified the South American treasures, Darwin turned his mind to other problems. He was not a splitter, but a lumper, a seeker of deeper anatomy. Taxonomy and nomenclature were, for him, merely means to an end. His instinctive genius lay in unearthing patterns, systems of organization, that lay behind the specimens, not in kingdoms and orders, but in kingdoms of order that ran through the biological world. The same question that would frustrate Mendel in his teaching examination in Vienna, why on earth were living things organized in this manner, became Darwin's preoccupation in 1836. Two facts stood out that year. First, as Owen and Lyle pored through the fossils, they found an underlying pattern in the specimens. They were typically skeletons of colossal, extinct versions of animals that were still in existence at the very same locations where the fossils had been discovered. Giant-plated armadillos once roamed in the very valley where small armadillos were now moving through the brush. Gargantuan sloths had foraged where smaller sloths now resided. The huge femoral bones that Darwin had extracted from the soil belonged to a vast elephant-sized llama. Its smaller current version was unique to South America. The second bizarre fact came from Gould. In the early spring of 1837, Gould told Darwin that the assorted varieties of wrens, warblers, blackbirds, and grosbeaks that Darwin had sent him were not assorted or various at all. Darwin had misclassified them. They were all finches, an astonishing 13 species. Their beaks, claws, and plumage were so distinct that only a trained eye could have discerned the unity lurking beneath. The thin-throated wren-like warbler and the ham-necked pincer-beaked blackbirds were anatomical cousins, variants of the same species. The warbler likely fed on fruit and insects, hence that flute-like beak. The spanner-beaked finch was a seed-cracking ground forager, hence its nutcracker-like bill. And the mockingbirds that were endemic to each island were also three distinct species. Finches and finches everywhere. It was as if each site had produced its own variant, a bar-coded bird for each island. How could Darwin reconcile these two facts? Already the bare outline of an idea was coalescing in his mind. A notion so simple, and yet so deeply radical, that no biologist had dared to explore it fully. What if all the finches had arisen from a common ancestral finch? What if the small armadillos of today had arisen from a giant ancestral armadillo? Lyell had argued that the current landscape of the Earth was the consequence of natural forces that had accumulated over millions of years. In 1796, the French physicist Pierre-Simon Laplace had proposed that even the current solar system had arisen from the gradual cooling and condensation of matter over millions of years. When Napoleon had asked Laplace why God was so conspicuously missing from his theory, Laplace had replied with epic cheekiness, "Sire, I had no need for that hypothesis." What if the current forms of animals were also the consequence of natural forces that had accumulated over millennia? In July 1837, in the stifling heat of his study on Marlborough Street, Darwin began scribbling in a new notebook, the so-called Bee Notebook, firing off ideas about how animals could change over time. The notes were cryptic, spontaneous, and raw. On one page, he drew a diagram that would return to haunt his thoughts. Rather than all species radiating out from the central hub of divine creation, perhaps they arose like branches of a tree, or like rivulets from a river, with an ancestral stem that divided and subdivided into smaller and smaller branches toward dozens of modern descendants. Like languages, like landscapes, like the slowly cooling cosmos, perhaps the animals and plants had descended from earlier forms through a process of gradual, continuous change. It was, Darwin knew, an explicitly profane diagram. The Christian concept of speciation placed God firmly at the epicenter, all animals created by him sprayed outward from the moment of creation. In Darwin's drawing, there was no center. The 13 finches were not created by some divine whim, but by natural descent, cascading downward and outward from an original ancestral finch. The modern llama arose similarly, by descending from a giant ancestral beast. As an afterthought, he added, "I think," above the page, as if to signal his last point of departure from the mainlands of biological and theological thought. But, with God shoved aside, what was the driving force behind the origin of species? What impetus drove the descent of, say, 13 variants of finches down the fierce rivulets of speciation? In the spring of 1838, as Darwin tore into a new journal, the Maroon Sea Notebook, he had more thoughts on the nature of this driving force. The first part of the answer had been sitting under his nose since his childhood in the farmlands of Shrewsbury and Hereford. Darwin had merely traveled 8,000 miles around the globe to rediscover it. The phenomenon was called variation. Animals occasionally produced offspring with features different from the parental type. Farmers had been using this phenomenon for millennia, breeding and interbreeding animals to produce natural variants and selecting these variants over multiple generations. In England, farm breeders had refined the creation of novel breeds and variants to a highly sophisticated science. The shorthorn bulls of Hereford bore little resemblance to the longhorns of Craven. A curious naturalist traveling from the Galapagos to England, a Darwin in reverse, might have been astonished to find that each region had its own species of cow. But as Darwin or any bull breeder could tell you, the breeds had not arisen by accident. They had been deliberately created by humans, by the selective breeding of variants from the same ancestral cow. The deft combination of variation and artificial selection, Darwin knew, could produce extraordinary results. Pigeons could be made to look like roosters and peacocks, and dogs made short-haired, long-haired, pied, piebald, bow-legged, hairless, crop-tailed, vicious, mild-mannered, diffident, guarded, belligerent. But the force that had molded the selection of cows, dogs, and pigeons was the human hand. What hand, Darwin asked, had guided the creation of such different varieties of finches on those distant volcanic islands or made small armadillos out of giant precursors on the plains of South America? Darwin knew that he was now gliding along the dangerous edge of the known world, tacking south of heresy. He could easily have ascribed the invisible hand to God, but the answer that came to him in October 1838, in a book by another cleric, the Reverend Thomas Malthus, had nothing to do with divinity. Thomas Malthus had been a curate at the Oakwood Chapel in Surrey by daytime, but he was a closet economist by night. His true passion was the study of populations and growth. In 1798, writing under a pseudonym, Malthus had published an incendiary paper, an essay on the principle of population, in which he had argued that the human population was in constant struggle with its limited resource pool. As the population expanded, Malthus reasoned, its resource pool would be depleted and competition between individuals would grow severe. A population's inherent inclination to expand would be severely counterbalanced by the limitations of resources, its natural wont met by natural want. And then potent apocalyptic forces, sickly seasons, epidemics, pestilence, and plague, would advance in terrific array and sweep off their thousands and tens of thousands, leveling the population with the food of the world. Those that survived this natural selection would restart the grim cycle again, Sisyphus moving from one famine to the next. In Malthus's paper, Darwin immediately saw a solution to his quandary. This struggle for survival was the shaping hand. Death was nature's color, its grim shaper. "It had once struck me," he wrote, "that under these circumstances of natural selection, favorable variations would tend to be preserved and unfavorable ones to be destroyed. The results of this would be the formation of a new species." Darwin now had the skeletal sketch of his master theory. When animals reproduce, they produce variants that differ from the parents. Individuals within a species are constantly competing for scarce resources. When these resources form a critical bottleneck, during a famine, for instance, a variant better adapted for an environment is naturally selected. The best adapted, the fittest, survive. The phrase "survival of the fittest" was borrowed from the Malthusian economist Herbert Spencer. These survivors then reproduce to make more of their kind, thereby driving evolutionary change within a species. Darwin could almost see the process unfolding on the salty bays of Punta Alta or on the islands of the Galapagos, as if an eons-long film were running on fast forward, a millennium compressed to a minute. Flocks of finches fed on fruit until their population exploded. A bleak season came upon the island, a rotting monsoon or a parched summer, and fruit supplies dwindled drastically. Somewhere in the vast flock, A variant was born with a grotesque beak capable of cracking seeds. As famine raged through the finch world, this gross-beaked variant survived by feeding on hard seeds. It reproduced, and a new species of finch began to appear. The freak became the norm. As new Malthusian limits were imposed, diseases, famines, parasites, new breeds gained a stronghold and the population shifted again. Freaks became norms, and norms became extinct. Monster by monster, evolution advanced. By the winter of 1839, Darwin had assembled the essential outlines of his theory. Over the next few years, he tinkered and fussed obsessively with his ideas, arranging and rearranging ugly facts like his fossil specimens, but he never got around to publishing the theory. In 1844, he distilled the crucial parts of his thesis into a 255-page essay and mailed it to his friends to read privately. But he did not bother committing the essay to print. He concentrated instead on studying barnacles, writing papers on geology, dissecting sea animals, and tending to his family. His daughter Annie, the eldest and his favorite, contracted an infection and died, leaving Darwin numb with grief. A brutal internecine war broke out in the Crimean Peninsula. Men were hauled off to the battlefront, and Europe plunged into a depression. It was as if Malthus and the struggle for survival had come alive in the real world. In the summer of 1855, more than a decade and a half after Darwin had first read Malthus's essay and crystallized his ideas about speciation, a young naturalist, Alfred Russel Wallace, published a paper in the Annals and Magazine of Natural History that skirted dangerously close to Darwin's yet unpublished theory. Wallace and Darwin had emerged from vastly different social and ideological backgrounds. Unlike Darwin, landed cleric, gentleman biologist, and soon to be England's most lauded natural historian, Wallace had been born to a middle-class family in Monmouthshire. He too had read Malthus's paper on populations, not in an armchair in his study, but on the hardback benches of the Free Library at Leicester. Malthus's book was widely circulated in intellectual circles in Great Britain. Like Darwin, Wallace had also embarked on a seafaring journey to Brazil to collect specimens and fossils, and had emerged transformed. In 1854, having lost the little money that he possessed and all the specimens that he had collected in a shipping disaster, an even more deeply impoverished Wallace moved from the Amazon basin to another series of scattered volcanic islands, the Malay Archipelago, on the edge of southeastern Asia. There, like Darwin, he observed astonishing differences between closely related species that had been separated by channels of water. By the winter of 1857, Wallace had begun to formulate a general theory about the mechanism driving variation in these islands. That spring, lying in bed with a hallucinatory fever, he stumbled upon the last missing piece of his theory. He recalled Malthus's paper. The answer was clearly that the best fitted variants live. In this way, every part of an animal's organization could be modified exactly as required. Even the language of his thoughts, variation, mutation, survival, and selection, bore striking similarities to Darwin's. Separated by oceans and continents, buffeted by very different intellectual winds, the two men had sailed to the same port. In June 1858, Wallace sent Darwin a tentative draft of his paper outlining his general theory of evolution by natural selection. Stunned by the similarities between Wallace's theory and his own, a panicked Darwin dashed his own manuscript off to his old friend Lyell. Cannily, Lyell advised Darwin to have both papers presented simultaneously at the meeting of the Linnaean Society that summer, so that both Darwin and Wallace could simultaneously be credited for their discoveries. On July 1, 1858, Darwin's and Wallace's papers were read back-to-back and discussed publicly in London. The audience was not particularly enthusiastic about either study. The next May, the president of the society remarked parenthetically that the past year had not yielded any particularly noteworthy discoveries. Darwin now rushed to finish the monumental opus that he had originally intended to publish with all his findings. In 1859, he contacted the publisher John Murray hesitantly. "I heartily hope that my book may be sufficiently successful that you may not repent of having undertaken it." On November 24, 1859, on a wintry Thursday morning, Charles Darwin's book On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection appeared in bookstores in England, priced at 15 shillings a copy. 1,250 copies had been printed. As Darwin noted, stunned, all copies were sold on the first day. A torrent of ecstatic reviews appeared almost immediately. Even the earliest readers of Origin were aware of the book's far-reaching implications. The conclusions announced by Mr. Darwin are such as, if established, would cause a complete revolution in the fundamental doctrines of natural history, one reviewer wrote. We imply that his work is one of the most important that for a long time past have been given to public. Darwin had also fueled his critics. Perhaps wisely, he had been deliberately cagey about the implications of his theory for human evolution. The only line in Origin regarding human descent, "Light will be thrown on the origin of man and his history," might well have been the scientific understatement of the century. But Richard Owen, the fossil taxonomist, Darwin's frenemy, was quick to discern the philosophical implications of Darwin's theory. If the descent of species occurred as Darwin suggested, he reasoned, then the implication for human evolution was obvious. Man might be a transmuted ape, an idea so deeply repulsive that Owen could not even bear to contemplate it. Darwin had advanced the boldest new theory in biology, Owen wrote, without adequate experimental proof to support it. Rather than fruit, he had provided intellectual husks. Owen complained, quoting Darwin himself, "One's imagination must fill up very wide blanks." The Very Wide Blank. Now, I wonder if Mr. Darwin ever took the trouble to think how long it would take to exhaust any given original stock of gemmules. Seems to me if he had given it a casual thought, he surely would never have dreamt of pangenesis. Alexander Wilford Hall, 1880. It is a testament to Darwin's scientific audacity that he was not particularly bothered by the prospect of human descent from ape-like ancestors. It is also a testament to his scientific integrity that what did bother him with far fiercer urgency was the integrity of the internal logic of his own theory. One particularly wide blank had to be filled: heredity. A theory of heredity, Darwin realized, was not peripheral to a theory of evolution. It was of pivotal importance. For a variant of grosbeaked finch to appear on a Galapagos island by natural selection, two seemingly contradictory facts had to be simultaneously true. First, a short-beaked normal finch must be able to occasionally produce a gross-beaked variant, a monster or freak. Darwin called these sports, an evocative word suggesting the infinite caprice of the natural world. The crucial driver of evolution, Darwin understood, was not nature's sense of purpose, but her sense of humor. And second, once born, that gross-beaked finch must be able to transmit the same trait to its offspring, thereby fixing the variation for generations to come. If either factor failed, if reproduction failed to produce variants, or if heredity failed to transmit the variations, then nature would be mired in a ditch, the cogwheels of evolution jammed. For Darwin's theory to work, heredity had to possess constancy and inconstancy, stability and mutation. Darwin wondered incessantly about a mechanism of heredity that could achieve these counterbalanced properties. In Darwin's time, the most commonly accepted mechanism of heredity was a theory advanced by the 18th century French biologist Jean-Baptiste Lamarck. In Lamarck's view, hereditary traits were passed from parents to offspring in the same manner that a message or story might be passed, i.e. by instruction. Lamarck believed that animals, adapted to their environments by strengthening or weakening certain traits, with a power proportional to the length of time it has been so used. A finch forced to feed on hard seeds adapted by strengthening its beak. Over time, the finch's beak would harden and become pincer-shaped. This adapted feature would then be transmitted to the finch's offspring by instruction, and their beaks would harden as well, having been pre-adapted to the harder seeds by their parents. By similar logic, antelopes that foraged on tall trees found that they had to extend their necks to reach the high foliage. By use and disuse, as Lamarck put it, Their necks would stretch and lengthen, and these antelopes would produce long-necked offspring, thereby giving rise to giraffes. Note the similarities between Lamarck's theory of the body giving instructions to sperm and Pythagoras's conception of human heredity, with sperm collecting messages from all organs. The immediate appeal of Lamarck's idea was that it offered a reassuring story of progress. All animals were progressively adapting to their environments, and thus progressively slouching along an evolutionary ladder toward perfection. Evolution and adaptation were bundled together into one continuous mechanism. Adaptation was evolution. The scheme was not just intuitive. It was also conveniently divine, or close enough for a biologist's work. Although initially created by God, animals still had a chance to perfect their forms in the changing natural world. The divine chain of being still stood. If anything, it stood even more upright. At the end of the long chain of adaptive evolution was the well-adjusted, best-directed, most perfected mammal of them all, humans. Darwin had obviously split ways with Lamarck's evolutionary ideas. Giraffes hadn't arisen from straining antelopes needing skeletal neck braces. They had emerged, loosely speaking, because an ancestral antelope had produced a long-necked variant that had been progressively selected by a natural force, such as a famine. But Darwin kept returning to the mechanism of heredity. What had made the long-necked antelope emerge in the first place? Darwin tried to envision a theory of heredity that would be compatible with evolution. But here, his crucial intellectual shortcoming came to the fore. He was not a particularly gifted experimentalist. Mendel, as we shall see, was an instinctual gardener, a breeder of plants, a counter of seeds, an isolator of traits. Darwin was a garden digger, a classifier of plants, an organizer of specimens, a taxonomist. Mendel's gift was experimentation, the manipulation of organisms, cross-fertilization of carefully selected subbreeds, the testing of hypotheses. Darwin's gift was natural history, the reconstruction of history by observing nature. Mendel the monk was an isolator. Darwin, the parson, a synthesizer. But observing nature, it turned out, was very different from experimenting with nature. Nothing about the natural world, at first glance, suggests the existence of a gene. Indeed, you have to perform rather bizarre experimental contortions to uncover the idea of discrete particles of inheritance. Unable to arrive at a theory of heredity via experimental means, Darwin was forced to conjure one up from purely theoretical grounds. He struggled with the concept for nearly 2 years, driving himself to the brink of a mental breakdown before he thought he had stumbled on an adequate theory. Darwin imagined that the cells of all organisms produce minute particles containing hereditary information. Gemmules, he called them. These gemmules circulate in the parent's body. When an animal or plant reaches its reproductive age, the information in the gemmules is transmitted to germ cells, sperm and egg. Thus, the information about a body's state is transmitted from parents to offspring during conception. As with Pythagoras, in Darwin's model, every organism carried information to build organs and structures in miniaturized form. Except, in Darwin's case, the information was decentralized. An organism was built by parliamentary ballot. Gemmules secreted by the hand carried the instructions to manufacture a new hand. Gemmules dispersed by the ear transmitted the code to build a new ear. How were these gemmular instructions from a father and a mother applied to a developing fetus? Here, Darwin reverted to an old idea. The instructions from the male and female simply met in the embryo and blended together like paints or colors. This notion, blending inheritance, was already familiar to most biologists. It was a restatement of Aristotle's theory of mixing between male and female characters. Darwin had, it seemed, achieved yet another marvelous synthesis between opposing poles of biology. He had melded the Pythagorean homunculus, gemmules, with the Aristotelian notion of message and mixture, blending, into a new theory of heredity. Darwin dubbed his theory pangenesis, genesis from everything, since all organs contributed gemmules. In 1867, nearly a decade after the publication of Origin, he began to complete a new manuscript, The Variation of Animals and Plants Under Domestication, in which he would fully explicate this view of inheritance. "It is a rash and crude hypothesis," Darwin confessed, "but it has been a considerable relief to my mind." He wrote to his friend Asa Gray, "Pangenesis will be called a mad dream, but at the bottom of my own mind, I think it contains a great truth." Darwin's considerable relief could not have been long-lived. He would soon be awoken from his mad dream. That summer, while Variation was being compiled into its book form, a review of his earlier book, Origin, appeared in the North British Review. Buried in the text of that review was the most powerful argument against pangenesis that Darwin would encounter in his lifetime. The author of the review was an unlikely critic of Darwin's work, a mathematician, engineer, and inventor from Edinburgh named Fleming Jenkin, who had rarely written about biology. Brilliant and abrasive, Jenkin had diverse interests in linguistics, electronics, mechanics, arithmetic, physics, chemistry, and economics. He read widely and profusely Dickens, Dumas, Austin, Eliot, Newton, Malthus, Lamarck. Having chanced upon Darwin's book, Jenkin read it thoroughly, worked swiftly through the implications, and immediately found a fatal flaw in the argument. Jenkin's central problem with Darwin was this. If hereditary traits kept blending with each other in every generation, then what would keep any variation from being diluted out immediately by interbreeding? "The variant will be swamped by the numbers," Jenkin wrote, "and after a few generations its peculiarity will be obliterated." As an example, colored deeply by the casual racism of his era, Jenkin concocted a story. "Suppose a white man to have been wrecked on an island inhabited by Negroes. Our shipwrecked hero would probably become king. He would kill a great many blacks in the struggle for existence. He would have a great many wives and children. But if genes blended with each other, then Jenkin's white man was fundamentally doomed, at least in a genetic sense. His children, from black wives, would presumably inherit half his genetic essence. His grandchildren would inherit a quarter, his great-grandchildren an eighth, his great-great-grandchildren 1/16, and so forth, until his genetic essence had been diluted in just a few generations into complete oblivion. Even if white genes were the most superior, the fittest, to use Darwin's terminology, nothing would protect them from the inevitable decay caused by blending. In the end, the lone white king of the island would vanish from its genetic history, even though he had fathered more children than any other man of his generation, and even though his genes were best suited for survival. The particular details of Jenkin's story were ugly, perhaps deliberately so, but its conceptual point was clear. If heredity had no means of maintaining variance, of fixing the altered trait, then all alterations in characters would eventually vanish into colorless oblivion by virtue of blending. Freaks would always remain freaks, unless they could guarantee the passage of their traits to the next generation. Prospero could safely afford to create a single Caliban on an isolated island and let him roam at large. Blending inheritance would function as his natural genetic prison. Even if he mated, precisely when he mated, his hereditary features would instantly vanish into a sea of normalcy. Blending was the same as infinite dilution, and no evolutionary information could be maintained in the face of such dilution. When a painter begins to paint, dipping the brush occasionally to dilute the pigment, the water might initially turn blue or yellow, but as more and more paints are diluted into the water, it inevitably turns to murky gray. Add more colored paint and the water remains just as intolerably gray. If the same principle applied to animals and inheritance, then what force could possibly conserve any distinguishing feature of any variant organism? Why, Jenkin might ask, weren't all Darwin's finches gradually turning gray? Darwin was deeply struck by Jenkin's reasoning. "Fleming Jenkins has given me much trouble," he wrote, "but has been of more use to me than any other essay or review." There was no denying Jenkins' inescapable logic. To salvage Darwin's theory of evolution, he needed a congruent theory of heredity. But what features of heredity might solve Darwin's problem? For Darwinian evolution to work, the mechanism of inheritance had to possess an intrinsic capacity to conserve information without becoming diluted or dispersed. Blending would not work. There had to be atoms of information, discrete, insoluble, indelible particles moving from parent to child. Was there any proof of such constancy in inheritance? Had Darwin looked carefully through the books in his voluminous library, he might have found a reference to an obscure paper by a little-known botanist from Brno, unassumingly entitled Experiments in Plant Hybridization, and published in a scarcely read journal in 1866. The paper was written in dense German and packed with the kind of mathematical tables that Darwin particularly despised. Even so, Darwin came tantalizingly close to reading it. In the early 1870s, poring through a book on plant hybrids, he made extensive handwritten notes on pages 50, 51, 53, and 54, but mysteriously skipped page 52, where the Brno paper on pea hybrids was discussed in detail. If Darwin had actually read it, particularly as he was writing Variation and formulating Pangenesis, this study might have provided the final critical insight to understand his own theory of evolution. He would have been fascinated by its implications, moved by the tenderness of its labor, and struck by its strange explanatory power. Darwin's incisive intellect would quickly have grasped its implications for the understanding of evolution. He may also have been pleased to note that the paper had been authored by another cleric who, in another epic journey from theology to biology, had also drifted off the edge of a map, an Augustine monk named Gregor Johann Mendel. Flowers He Loved. As Darwin was beginning to write his opus on evolution in the spring of 1856, Gregor Mendel decided to return to Vienna to retake the teacher's exam that he had failed in 1850. He felt more confident this time. Mendel had spent 2 years studying physics, chemistry, geology, botany, and zoology at the university in Vienna. In 1853, he had returned to the monastery and started work as a substitute teacher at the Brno Modern School. The monks who ran the school were very particular about tests and qualifications, and it was time to try the certifying exam again. Mendel applied to take the test. Unfortunately, this second attempt was also a disaster. Mendel was ill, most likely from anxiety. He arrived in Vienna with a sore head and a foul temper, and quarreled with the botany examiner on the first day of the 3-day test. The topic of disagreement is unknown, but likely concerned species formation, variation, and heredity. Mendel did not finish the exam. He returned to Brno reconciled to his destiny as a substitute teacher. He never attempted to obtain certification again. Late that summer, still bruising from his failed exam, Mendel planted a crop of peas. It wasn't his first crop. He had been breeding peas inside the glass hothouse for about 3 years. He had collected 34 strains from the neighboring farms and bred them to select the strains that bred true. That is, every pea plant produced exactly identical offspring, with the same flower color or the same seed texture. These plants remained constant without exception, he wrote. Like always begat like. He had collected the founding material for his experiment. The true-bred pea plants, he noted, possessed distinct traits that were hereditary and variant. Bred to themselves, tall-stemmed plants generated only tall plants. Short plants only dwarf ones. Some strains produced only smooth seeds, while others produced only angular, wrinkled seeds. The unripe pods were either green or vividly yellow. The ripe pods either loose or tight. He listed the 7 such true breeding traits. 1. The texture of the seed, smooth versus wrinkled. 2. The color of seeds, yellow versus green. 3. The color of the flower, white versus violet. 4. The position of the flower, at the tip of the plant versus the branches. 5. The color of the pea pod, green versus yellow. 6. The shape of the pea pod, smooth versus crumpled. 7. The height of the plant, tall versus short. Every trait, Mendel noted, came in at least 2 different variants. They were like 2 alternative spellings of the same word, or 2 colors of the same jacket. Mendel experimented with only 2 variants of the same trait, although in nature there might be multiple ones, such as white, purple, mauve, and yellow flowering plants. Biologists would later term these variants alleles, from the Greek word allos, loosely referring to two different subtypes of the same general kind. Purple and white were two alleles of the same trait, flower color. Long and short were two alleles of another characteristic, height. The purebred plants were only a starting point for his experiment. To reveal the nature of heredity, Mendel knew that he needed to breed hybrids. Only a bastard, a word commonly used by German botanists to describe experimental hybrids, could reveal the nature of purity. Contrary to later belief, he was acutely aware of the far-reaching implication of his study. His question was crucial to the history of the evolution of organic forms, he wrote. In 2 years, astonishingly, Mendel had produced a set of reagents that would allow him to interrogate some of the most important features of heredity. Put simply, Mendel's question was this: if he crossed a tall plant with a short one, would there be a plant of intermediate size? Would the two alleles, shortness and tallness, blend? The production of hybrids was tedious work. Peas typically self-fertilize. The anther and the stamen mature inside the flower's clasp-like keel, and the pollen is dusted directly from a flower's anther to its own stamen. Cross-fertilization was another matter altogether. To make hybrids, Mendel had to first neuter each flower by snipping off the anthers, emasculating it, and then transfer the orange blush of pollen from one flower to another. He worked alone, stooping with a paintbrush and forceps to snip and dust the flowers. He hung his outdoor hat on a harp, so that every visit to the garden was marked by the sound of a single crystalline note. This was his only music. It's hard to know how much the other monks in the abbey knew about Mendel's experiments, or how much they cared. In the early 1850s, Mendel had tried a more audacious variation of this experiment, starting with white and gray field mice. He had bred mice in his room, mostly undercover, to try to produce mice hybrids. But the abbot, although generally tolerant of Mendel's whims, had intervened. A monk coaxing mice to mate to understand heredity was a little too risque, even for the Augustinians. Mendel had switched to plants and moved the experiments to the hothouse outside. The abbot had acquiesced. He drew the line at mice, but didn't mind giving peas a chance. By the late summer of 1857, the first hybrid peas had bloomed in the abbey garden, in a riot of purple and white. Mendel noted the colors of the flowers, and when the vines had hung their pods, he slit open the shells to examine the seeds. He set up new hybrid crosses, tall with short, yellow with green, wrinkled with smooth. In yet another flash of inspiration, he crossed some hybrids to each other, making hybrids of hybrids. The experiments went on in this manner for 8 years. The plantings had by then expanded from the hothouse to a plot of land by the abbey, a 20-foot by 100-foot rectangle of loam that bordered the refectory, visible from his room. When the wind blew the shades of his window open, it was as if the entire room turned into a giant microscope. Mendel's notebook was filled with tables and scribblings, with data from thousands of crosses. His thumbs were getting numb from the shelling. "How small a thought it takes to fill someone's whole life," the philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein wrote. Indeed, at first glance, Mendel's life seemed to be filled with the smallest thoughts. Sow, pollinate, bloom, pluck, shell, count, repeat. The process was excruciatingly dull, but small thoughts, Mendel knew, often bloomed into large principles. If the powerful scientific revolution that had swept through Europe in the 18th century had one legacy, it was this: the laws that ran through nature were uniform and pervasive. The force that drove Newton's apple from the branch to his head was the same force that guided planets along their celestial orbits. If heredity, too, had a universal natural law, then it was likely influencing the genesis of peas as much as the genesis of humans. Mendel's garden plot may have been small, but he did not confuse its size with that of his scientific ambition. The experiments progressed slowly, Mendel wrote. At first, a certain amount of patience was needed, but I soon found that matters were better when I was conducting several experiments simultaneously. With multiple crosses in parallel, the production of data accelerated. Gradually, he began to discern patterns in the data: unanticipated constancies, conserved ratios, numerical rhythms. he had tapped at last into heredity's inner logic. The first pattern was easy to perceive. In the first generation hybrids, the individual heritable traits, tallness and shortness, or green and yellow seeds, did not blend at all. A tall plant crossed with a dwarf inevitably produced only tall plants. Round-seeded peas crossed with wrinkled seeds produced only round peas. All seven of the traits followed this pattern. The hybrid character was not intermediate, but resembled one of the parental forms, he wrote. Mendel termed these overriding traits dominant, while the traits that had disappeared were termed recessive. Had Mendel stopped his experiments here, he would already have made a major contribution to a theory of heredity. The existence of dominant and recessive alleles for a trait contradicted 19th-century theories of blending inheritance. The hybrids that Mendel had generated did not possess intermediate features. Only one allele had asserted itself in the hybrid, forcing the other variant trait to vanish. But where had the recessive trait disappeared? Had it been consumed or eliminated by the dominant allele? Mendel deepened his analysis with his second experiment. He bred short, tall hybrids with short, tall hybrids to produce third-generation progeny. Since tallness was dominant, all the parental plants in this experiment were tall to start. The recessive trait had disappeared, but when crossed with each other, Mendel found, they yielded an entirely unexpected result. In some of these third-generation crosses, shortness reappeared, perfectly intact, after having disappeared for a generation. The same pattern occurred with all seven of the other traits. White flowers vanished in the second generation, the hybrids, only to reemerge in some members of the third. A hybrid organism, Mendel realized, was actually a composite, with a visible dominant allele and a latent recessive allele. Mendel's word to describe these variants was forms. The word allele would be coined by geneticists in the 1900s. By studying the mathematical relationships, the ratios, between the various kinds of progeny produced by each cross, Mendel could begin to construct a model to explain the inheritance of traits. Every trait in Mendel's model was determined by an independent, indivisible particle of information. The particles came in two variants, or two alleles, short versus tall for height, or white versus violet for flower color, and so forth. Every plant inherited one copy from each parent, one allele from father via sperm, and one from mother via the egg. When a hybrid was created, both traits existed intact, although only one asserted its existence. Between 1857 and 1864, Mendel shelled bushel upon bushel of peas, compulsively tabulating the results for each hybrid cross, yellow seeds, green cotyledons, white flowers. The results remained strikingly consistent. The small patch of land in the monastery garden produced an overwhelming volume of data to analyze. 28,000 plants, 40,000 flowers, and nearly 400,000 seeds. It requires indeed some courage to undertake a labor of such far-reaching extent, Mendel would write later. But courage is the wrong word here. More than courage, something else is evident in that work, a quality that one can only describe as tenderness. It is a word not typically used to describe science or scientists. It shares roots, of course, with tending, a farmer's or gardener's activity, but also with tension, the stretching of a pea tendril to incline it towards sunlight or to train it on an arbor. Mendel was, first and foremost, a gardener. His genius was not fueled by deep knowledge of the conventions of biology. Thankfully, he had failed that exam, twice. Rather, it was his instinctual knowledge of the garden, coupled with an incisive power of observation. The laborious cross-pollination of seedlings, the meticulous tabulation of the colors of cotyledons, that soon led him to findings that could not be explained by the traditional understanding of inheritance. Heredity, Mendel's experiments implied, could only be explained by the passage of discrete pieces of information from parents to offspring. Sperm brought one copy of this information, an allele. The egg brought the other copy, a second allele. An organism thus inherited one allele from each parent. When that organism generated sperm or eggs, the alleles were split up again. One was passed to the sperm and one to the egg, only to become combined in the next generation. One allele might dominate the other when both were present. When the dominant allele was present, the recessive allele seemed to disappear. But when a plant received two recessive alleles, the allele reiterated its character. Throughout, the information carried by an individual allele remained indivisible. The particles themselves remained intact. Doppler's example returned to Mendel. There was music behind noise, laws behind seeming lawlessness, and only a profoundly artificial experiment, creating hybrids out of purebred strains carrying simple traits, could reveal these underlying patterns. Behind the epic variance of natural organisms, tall, short, wrinkled, smooth, green, yellow, brown, there were corpuscles of hereditary information moving from one generation to the next. Each trait was unitary, distinct, separate, and indelible. Mendel did not give this unit of heredity a name, but he had discovered the most essential features of a gene. On February 8, 1865, 7 years after Darwin and Wallace had read their papers at the Linnaean Society in London, Mendel presented his paper in two parts at a much less august forum. He spoke to a group of farmers, botanists, and biologists at the Natural Science Society in Brno. The second part of the paper was read on March 8, a month later. Few records exist of this moment in history. The room was small, and about 40 people attended. The paper, with dozens of tables and arcane symbols to denote traits and variants, was challenging, even for statisticians. For biologists, it may have seemed like absolute mumbo-jumbo. Botanists generally studied morphology, not numerology. The counting of variants in seeds and flowers across tens of thousands of hybrid specimens must have mystified Mendel's contemporaries. The notion of mystical numerical harmonies lurking in nature had gone out of fashion with Pythagoras. Soon after Mendel was done, a professor of botany stood up to discuss Darwin's origin and the theory of evolution. No one in the audience perceived a link between the two subjects being discussed. Even if Mendel was aware of a potential connection between his units of heredity and evolution, his prior notes had certainly indicated that he had sought such a link. He made no explicit comments on the topic. Mendel's paper was published in the annual Proceedings of the Brno Natural Science Society. A man of few words, Mendel was even more concise in his writing. He had distilled nearly a decade's work into 44 spectacularly dreary pages. Copies were sent to the Royal Society and the Linnaean Society in England and to the Smithsonian in Washington, among dozens of institutions. Mendel himself requested 40 reprints, which he mailed, heavily annotated, to many scientists. It is likely that he sent one to Darwin, but there is no record of Darwin's having actually read it. What followed, as one geneticist wrote, was one of the strangest silences in the history of biology. The paper was cited only 4 times between 1866 and 1900, virtually disappearing from scientific literature. Between 1890 and 1900, even as questions and concerns about human heredity and its manipulation became central to policymakers in America and Europe, Mendel's name and his work were lost to the world. The study that founded modern biology was buried in the pages of an obscure journal of an obscure scientific society, read mostly by plant breeders in a declining Central European town. On New Year's Eve in 1866, Mendel wrote to the Swiss plant physiologist Karl von Nageli in Munich, enclosing a description of his experiments. Nageli replied 2 months later, already signaling distance with his tardiness, sending a courteous but icy note. A botanist of some repute, Nageli did not think much of Mendel or his work. Nageli had an instinctual distrust of amateur scientists and scribbled a puzzlingly derogatory note next to the first letter. Only empirical, cannot be proved rational, as if experimentally deduced laws were worse than those created de novo by human reason. Mendel pressed on with further letters. Nageli was the scientific colleague whose respect Mendel most sought, and his notes to him took an almost ardent, desperate turn.